going to be a test to make sure we're getting the recording. You've got your voice right. Why don't you start off by telling me your name and where you grew up?
Robert M. Dillett, D-I-L-L-E-T-T. My hometown is Shawnee. It's about 40 miles north of Green Bay.
Okay, Mr. Dillett, you were raised in Shawnee. Did you spend your entire youth there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In high school, when in your life did you decide to go to college?
Well, I had a career in journalism in mind, and I began working in the local paper when I finished eighth grade. So I had always had University of Wisconsin first in mind, and that's what I decided.
So you hadn't considered going to any other college?
No.
Pretty much UW. What kind of a reputation did UW have up around Shawnee?
Well, we were talking about this last night, and certainly it was considered atheistic. And I had people tell me, you better be on your guard going down there, going to preserve your religion. I think that part of this, perhaps, was professors like Max Carl Otto, whom everybody in our class loved, and he's the only man who ever got me to read the Bible. In one of his lectures, he gave us a challenge, and he said, what were the only words that Jesus ever wrote? It's given in the Bible. And so we all went to the Bible and found out that the words that Jesus wrote were written in the sand along the lake.
So Max Otto, the great atheist, was the person who got you to read the Bible. That's great. How did you apply to UW? Do you remember?
Oh, no, I don't have any recollection of how I applied. I suppose it was done through the high school authority. I don't.
Did you have any people come to your school and talk about UW?
No, never. I think that one of the weaknesses of the educational system today is still very poor career counseling. In fact, that's one of the projects I'm working on now since I'm retired. And most high schools don't have good career counseling.
And your high school was no exception?
No exception.
So it was your motivation?
Well, I knew what I wanted to do. And there are so many people, young people that I meet today, are in college even, and don't know what they want to do, you know.
Yeah. Okay, you were accepted into UW and you came down in the fall. What years were you here now?
1930 in the fall.
In the fall of 1930. How did you travel to UW?
Rode with some friends who are upperclassmen, came down with them.
So you did you have a place to live and everything?
No, I just set out and I found a place in, I think it was in North Lake Street. And the next morning when I woke up, there were four or five men lined up for the bathroom, and they were all Orientals, so I decided I wasn't going to live there. I lived on North Francis. In fact, yesterday I walked down to find North Francis Street, and it isn't there anymore. So I lived there for a year and then joined a fraternity.
Let's see. You were living in a boarding house your first year then?
Not a boarding house, a rooming house.
A rooming house. How many people lived in that?
Four.
Did you have a landlady? Or?
Oh, yeah.
What was the setup in those places? Did you each have your rooms and meals?
Well, I roomed with Rod Porter from Portage, and he was a sophomore then, and we had a large living room or study room, and then a separate bedroom, two single beds in it.
And did you eat together as a group normally?
No.
What about house rules? Were there any house rules?
Yeah.
So you had pretty much free play as a coming and going?
That's right.
How did you decide what courses to take in your freshman year?
Well, you don't have much choice in freshman year. I think that the journalism school here, at that time at least, emphasized general letters and science courses, and you didn't get into serious journalism courses till your third and fourth year.
So you're pretty much the basic.
So it was history and English and I had to take one science course. That was a requirement, five-credit course. I think there was just an introduction to journalism.
Do you remember any orientation on the session when you came as a freshman?
Well, everybody had an advisor. I had an advisor in the journalism department, and he talked to me, but I mean, it was not principally about course selection, because this was pretty well ordained.
Is it fair for me to say that in your freshman year, at least, that you were pretty much on your own academically in terms of choosing pending courses?
Oh, yes, that's correct.
Where did you get books and supplies?
The bookstore, I think it's across the street now, but I think it was at Lake and Langdon somewhere, yeah. University bookstore.
Okay, so it was the university bookstore.
Yeah.
Okay. Your classes, how often did they normally meet?
There was usually one lecture a week, which would be in an auditorium, attended by perhaps 400 people. And then the quiz courses, there were usually two of those during the week. And there you were perhaps 30 people.
And that was taught by graduate assistants?
Graduate assistants, yes. They were not.
So they were really your link to the course?
That's right.
Did you ever get to meet with the professors in those courses? Or were you?
Not at the first 2 years. Later, with the School of Journalism, I met with the top people.
How did you dress for class? How did students generally dress, male and female?
Suit and tie.
Suit and tie?
Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty much all your summer, in summer school as well?
I never attended summer school here, but I think it was a little more informal.
What about women? Did they wear slacks?
No, dresses.
What about
professors? And skirts. Hmm?
Professors, how did they dress?
They were, formal too.
Was it pretty much, did graduate assistants who were in your TAs, did they dress pretty much the same as the professors?
Yeah.
Were they called TAs?
That expression, I'm not even familiar with.
Okay,
what
teaching assistant.
Teaching assistant. Mm-hmm.
What were they called then?
Instructors,
okay. Did many students, to your knowledge, cut classes? Is that fairly common?
I don't think that was much of a problem.
Were there ever any discipline problems in classes that you can remember?
I never had. I don't remember any discipline problems.
Was plagiarism ever an issue on campus when you were here? Either in your classes or generally?
Oh, I'm sure it went on, but I don't recall any incidents.
What about grades? How important were they to you?
Grades were not terribly important. I mean, I began working in the Cardinal as a freshman, and I was much more interested in that kind of experience and getting grades. I don't think I got any A's, maybe a couple.
What about your parents? Were grades important to them?
No. My father had died about 5 years before I came to college, and my mother was interested in my pursuing my career in journalism. She was a journalist herself.
Oh, she was? Mm-hmm. And did she work in Toronto?
Yes, for the Green Bay Press Gazette.
When did you declare a major?
Oh, freshman year.
Mm-hmm. But you couldn't go into the stuff in the course of your junior year.
That's right, and I think that's a darn good idea. I think Wisconsin Journalism School still has that reputation, and so many of the other journalism schools begin teaching nuts and bolts. The only thing that I regret about the journalism school, it was just journalism. There was no broadcast media, nothing like that. And of course today, most colleges call it a school of communications, so it covers all areas.
It's expanding. Did you have to write a senior thesis in journalism?
No.
Okay. What was your favorite class within your area of specialization, within journalism?
I think special writing.
Tell me a little bit about who taught it and what it did.
It was a lady, I'm trying to remember, Helen Patterson. And we could write articles about any subject we chose, and it was our responsibility to submit these articles to the papal publications. And as part of this course, you had to get, of course, it'd be great if you got an article accepted, but you had to come in with at least 10 rejection slips. So everybody was busy writing and sending things off and getting them back.
Did you fulfill the requirement?
Mm-hmm.
Did anyone...
Rejection slips.
Wonderful. Did anyone sell any articles?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What about outside of your area of specialization? What is your favorite or most memorable class?
Oh, I think Max Carlotto's course, probably.
Now, that was Nature of Man.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about his teaching style, his classes.
Well, he was a very humane person, a very warm and likable person. And I remember one story that Frank Lloyd Wright had designed the new Unitarian Church in Madison. Mm-hmm. And Max Carlotto was there at the time that it was being dedicated. And Frank Lloyd Wright positioned himself with the sun coming through the windows and his flowing hair, and he proceeded to say that he had designed this church in three sections representing the Trinity. And Max Carlotto turned to me and said, "Somebody forgot to tell them the Unitarians don't believe in the Trinity."
Did he have a pretty good reputation among students in general, Max?
Oh, yes.
Well, he did mainly lecture, I assume.
Yes,
that's how
right.
Most of them were.
That's right.
The big ones. Was he a good lecturer?
Excellent.
Yeah. What
Another
about
excellent lecturer was Kiekhofer in economics. Everyone
was lectures. Kiekhofer's wall up at that
Oh,
point?
Yes, yeah. That's
did you make
gone,
any,
I'm sure.
any contributions to it?
No. I commented last night as we were walking around town that Madison shows no signs of graffiti at all. And I come from Philadelphia, and graffiti is a tremendous problem. And here, I haven't seen any.
Well, there's it's here and there, but I know what you mean. I go to Chicago frequently. Mm-hmm. It's not quite the same. Was there any justification as far as you could see? You talked earlier about Max Otto having a reputation as an atheist. Was there any justification as far as you could see from your experience with him in the class as an atheist or a radical?
Oh, no. None at all. He welcomed individual thinking and was quite willing to sit down with students and discuss ideas.
Well, that might be radical in itself.
Well, subtle maybe.
What about your worst class? Did you have a class that, like in journalism, that is sort of like statistics is today to lots of people in different fields?
I can't remember any worst class.
Okay. Can you talk about any other professors on campus who you had or who you knew about who were noted as excellent teachers or as eccentric personalities? Researcher.
Well, in the journalism school at that time, we had Dr. Blyer, who was chairman, and Grant Hyde, who later succeeded him as chairman, and Ralph Napsiger, who I believe later became
mm-hmm.
chairman. And those three were all outstanding teachers and lecturers.
Tell me first, let's go through those three. They're very key names. You just probably knew the three of the key names in the journalism school for that period. Tell me a little bit about Professor Blyer first.
Well, he had a real sense of humor. I remember one day when he finished with his lecture, he invited questions, as any good instructor will do. And I raised my hand and asked a question. And he said, "Mr. Dillon, that was in today's reading assignment." And that was the end of it.
So much for the answer to that question. How was he as a teacher?
Very good.
In what ways?
Well, you had a feeling that he knew the field so thoroughly, and you just had complete confidence in him.
What was his area of expertise?
Newspaper.
Just the general writing
yeah,
for newspaper?
Yeah.
What course did you take from him?
News writing.
Mm-hmm. And was that a requirement for
Oh, yes.
And he was the person who taught that mm-hmm. to everyone
mm-hmm. who went through.
What about Grant?
Well, he was stiffer and less demonstrative than Blyer or Napsier. But Grant Hyde was a very human person, too, and when he let the walls of the reserve down a little bit, you got to know him. But he was a good teacher.
So he was a little more formal, maybe? Yes. A little less approachable?
Yes, right.
He was an older man than...
No, Blyer was older.
And what did Professor Hyde teach?
History of journalism.
And that, again, was a requirement?
Yes.
That all students, how was he as a teacher?
Excellent.
Napsinger. Ralph Napsinger.
Ralph Napsinger, yeah. Well, he was the student's best friend in the journalism department. In fact, he was advisor to the Daily Cardinal, so I got to know him very well through that. But he was an excellent man, and everybody appreciated that.
He left for a while, didn't he? Came back?
I believe so. It seems to me I read that he went to the University of Minnesota for a couple of years.
And then was hired back as
head of the department.
Head of the department, right. What course did he teach?
I can't remember specifically. Okay.
I want to get into his role as advisor on the Cardinal a little bit, but we'll catch up with that. How accessible were the journalism professors outside of the classroom?
Oh, they were all very accessible.
Did you take advantage of their accessibility?
Oh, yes.
Did you ever have contact with professors in non-academic situations? Frat parties or, teas or whatever?
No one in the professorial ranks.
Okay. No. Let's get into sort of the ranking. Would you be more likely to go off for like a cup of coffee with a grad assistant?
Yes, that happened.
And professors were accessible for academic purposes.
That's right.
But not really for any type of social.
That's right.
Type of thing. let's see. Housing. You said you lived in your rooming house, or rooming house?
Rooming.
Okay. For your first year. You switched to fraternities for your second year. Tell me about that.
Well, my second interest outside of journalism was speech, and I was on the freshman debate team, and I met a number of fellows on that, and my closest friend was Charlie Bridges, who eventually was president of the Interfraternity Council. And Charlie picked fellow debaters, Howard Schneider, and who became chairman of the Forensic Association, I believe it was called, and I, and asked us to join the fraternity. Our fraternity at that time had reached quite a low ebb, and I think there were only 9 actives and 1 pledge. And Charlie put me to work immediately. I was pledged and initiated and became rush chairman, and we got 30 in the rush that year, which was highly unusual, and the fraternity house came back. In fact, we were selected among the, I think about, at that time we had about 50 chapters, and we were the number one chapter in the country.
What was the name of your fraternity?
Beta Chi.
Beta Chi. Okay. Was it? You said that the person who recruited you did recruited people off the debate team. Was your fraternity primarily a sort of known as journalistic or debate, or did you have a wide diversity of people?
Wide diversity.
Was that common of most fraternities?
Yeah.
What about Rush? And we hear a lot about Hell Week and things like that. What was Hell Week like for you?
Well, I went through it, and then we agreed that was the last one we were going to have. So after our sophomore year, there we had a week of instruction and fraternity, that kind of thing. The only thing that we retained was a quest, which a man, well, for example, Mel Wunsch, could tell you about the coin. I asked him last night. He never told us who had advised him where the penny was hid in the stadium. And, He told me last night who it was.
After all these years, he finally learned the secret. Okay, it was abolished, the hazing and everything, after your year. What did that consist of for you? What was it like before you abolished it? What were some of the things you had to do?
Well, there was all of housework and stuff like that, of cleaning up the house, so that was part of it. And standing at the table at meals, and then paddles, or so, paddling, and that was just routine in, I think, almost every Greek house that time.
Now, you said you changed your rules the next year. Did the other Greeks do the same thing, or did they retain?
Some did, but most of them didn't.
Was it a campus-wide reform issue, or did you just initiate it yourself?
We just initiated it.
Okay. So you lived, is it the frat house you lived on up on Langdon?
Yeah, 144. It was down next to the CF house, which was on the lake. Okay. Delta Zeta was on the other side. It was Alpha Chi Omega was at the top of the hill.
Did you have your own room there?
Oh, yeah.
Or a roommate, your own room?
Well, we had both single and double rooms. I did both ways. My senior year, I roomed with Mel Wunsch.
Did you have communal meals there as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Was there any kind of dress requirement, or were you expected to dress in certain ways for these meals?
No.
Could you come down and
Sunday,
just casual
Sunday
slacks?
Was the, yeah, Sunday was the only day required to wear a jacket.
Okay, so it was different from some of the dorms. Mm-hmm. Dorms in that way. Was it considered higher status to be in a frat?
Well, I suppose so. I suppose so. I don't know whether you'd be interested in this, but when we had our elections for class president, the Greeks always ran one man, and the independents would run someone. And that year, Del Carlin, who was a Madison boy, was the independent choice. And I can't remember who the name of that Greek was. But we had 12 seniors in our fraternity. And we knew that was a solid block of votes if we could do something with it. The Daily Cardinal that year, it's one of its major objectives was to oust the secretary of the Wisconsin Alumni Association. And Del Carlin came to our class president, Charlie Bridges, and asked for support. And Charlie told him that maybe there could be a little quid pro quo here. And so he agreed to appoint people that we recommended to the senior council if we would support him. Del thoroughly canvassed the dorms. He didn't feel he was going to get very far with fraternities and sororities, but we cast a solid block of 12 votes, and Carlin won. It was the first time an independent, I believe, had ever won, at least in recent times. And then we got the appointments to the senior class president's council we had asked for, and the council voted not to join the Alumni Association as a class. This was the first time, and we asked, before we made this decision, asked to meet with the representatives of the Alumni Association. They were reluctant to even meet with us, and we finally got two of them to come to meet with us, and they showed no interest in firing their alumni secretary, and so we voted as a class not to join the Alumni Association. And this happened in the class of 35 and also in the class of 36, and in 36, the Alumni Secretary was fired.
Hmm. Who was the Alumni Secretary?
Herman L. Eggstead. He was called Wormy Herman by...
Why was he so objectionable?
Well, he was just... He wasn't approachable. He was an autocrat. And just the opposite from what you'd expect an Alumni Secretary to be.
Hmm. I want to turn now to your Cardinal involvement. Very interesting. Now, you said you started out as a freshman. Why don't we sort of go through your years, year by year, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, your increased involvement with the Cardinal. What did you start out doing?
Well, the Cardinal had beats for the young people, and you'd have certain offices that you were to call on for news, and this meant walking over to the office of the chairman of the department and finding out what was happening, what was planned, and then you, the next year, you did work on the desk, and this involved editing, and by the time you were a junior, by this time they had selected news editors, and there were three news editors, mm-hmm. each one working 2 days a week, mm-hmm. and they worked until the Cardinal was put to bed. And we were talking last night about the fact that as editor, in my junior year, I used to, of course, go down to the Cardinal offices every night before the paper went to bed at midnight, and they were wrestling with a story for a headline for a story. Porter Butts was with the union at that time, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Porter Butts. Mm-hmm. And the Madison merchants were upset because the Memorial Union was competing with them in a lot of merchandise and services and so on. And they had instituted a suit against the union. And so on this particular evening, the Madison merchants had decided that they should include Porter Butts in the suit. And he was named along with the union itself. So
getting an idea. Go ahead, what you're going to say. Go ahead.
We came down and they were wrestling with a headline, so we gave them one: Sight Butts in Union Suit.
What happened with that suit? Do you know?
No, I don't. I can't even remember how it ever ended, but I'm sure it may not be. Memorial Union didn't change its policy, so I guess the merchants lost.
Now, the Cardinal was controlled by the Cardinal Board of Control.
That's right.
I want to get the sort of logistics of this all straight.
There were elected students.
Elected by the students.
Yeah, and there were three seniors and two juniors on the Cardinal Board of Control. And there was a faculty advisor, who in our case was Ralph Mapson.
Okay, now, how much... what did Ralph Nassinger do, actually, in terms of the day-to-day or the long-term policy of the Cardinal?
Nothing.
He was a figurehead?
He was available for consultation, okay. Let's say that. When we had a problem that we wanted to discuss with him, he was always open and willing to give us his opinion.
So it wouldn't be his role to come and say, I don't agree with this editor?
Oh, no.
He would never do that. What about the Cardinal Board of Control? Would they get involved in that, those types of matters, or...? What did they do, essentially?
Well, I would have individual members of the Cardinal Board who would come in to see me on occasion and discuss our policies. And, you know, if they disagreed, I could either tell them to forget it, I'm going to do what I want to do, or agree to make some change.
Okay. Did you ever feel, as managing editor, did you ever feel any pressure from faculty or administration? Frank or anything?
I was executive editor. Mel Wunsch was managing editor.
I'm sorry, executive editor.
Yeah. No, one of the interesting things that we were talking about politics on the campus, there were three principal candidates for editor of the Cardinal a year that I was being considered. And we were all interviewed by the Cardinal Board of Control, and it was up to them to make a decision as to who the editor would be. And a close friend of mine was chairman of the Cardinal Board of Control. And he came back to the fraternity house one afternoon, and he said, well, we had two votes today. And the first, he said, I recommended, and Jane Pierce, who was a Kappa, recommended Maury Rubin for editor. And the vote was 3-2 against Rubin. He later became
Progressive,
yeah. Excellent man, he was from Portland, Maine. And he said, then we had a second vote, and the three dissident members, the ones who had voted against Rubin, proposed Les Lindau. And the vote was 3-2 in favor of Lindau. So Stoll came home to the fraternity house and said, you didn't make it. He said, how strong are your friendships on the Cardinal? And I said, well, I think I have excellent friendships on the Cardinal. He said, can you get them all to sign a petition saying that if Lindau is elected, they'll all resign? And I said, I think so. So I got almost everybody on the staff. Lindau was not that well-liked, and we had all these signatures for the chairman of the board. By that time, the elections had been held for the new incoming board members, and they were, Stoll had contacted them, and they had agreed that if Lindau was elected and installed as editor, that as soon as they took control of the board, they would oust Lindau and elect me, because they would then control the board. So, talk about politics. So this was submitted as a fact to the current board of control, and they changed their vote and voted 5-0 for me. Yeah. That was a strange situation.
What happened to Lindau then?
Oh, he left the paper. He had to stay with the paper. In fact, Reuben did too. He left.
It must have been a real tough time in terms of debate. So you became executive editor of the paper. What were your responsibilities as executive editor?
Well, of course, there was a sharp division between editorial and advertising, and I had nothing to do with the advertising. We had a business manager. On the editorial end, of course, the first thing you think of is the editorial board, mm-hmm. And I selected community leaders. Gene Heitkamp, who was at that time president of WSGA, was one of the writers. Howard Schneider, who eventually won the Miles Medal, was another. And we had about 7 people who met every day at 1 o'clock. And we decided what the editorial position was going to be on various topics, and assigned someone to write that at each editorial. The staff positions, the 3 news editors, of course, had to be selected and approved by me, and they were the, as they were the previous year, the 3 who would probably be considered for editor the following year. And overseeing the operation, I spent every afternoon at Cardinal and go down at night before the paper went to bed.
So being executive editor was pretty much a full-time job.
It was.
What if the Cardinal has over, periodically at times a reputation as sort of a radical newspaper. What kind of a reputation did it have in your times?
Well, there had been editors prior to me who were considered in that radical category, and usually they were from the East, mm-hmm. and usually they were Jewish, mm-hmm. and ours was Bedrock, Wisconsin, and we didn't have any of these extra liberal leanings. I mean, I'm proud of the liberalism of the of Wisconsin as a state and the university, but there was no radicalism. Of course, at that time we had a National Student League, and they met regularly and tried to create dissension, but radicalism was really not a major issue.
It certainly wasn't on your paper.
Oh, no.
So the way you could radicalize a paper would be to have a fairly radical board of control who could then appoint an editor who might reflect their values, and
that's right.
The editor in turn could then appoint an editorial board that would support his or her, well, his, I guess, in those days,
yeah.
Didn't assume the editorship till World War II period. Do you care to speculate on that observation about the Jewish, the early editors of Jewish and East, why they would be more radical?
Well, one of my close friends at the university was Joe Pishelson, and Joe is a very successful manufacturer out in Ohio now, mm-hmm. and I have been involved in the committee work for this reunion meeting in mm-hmm. Washington with Rex and others. And Joe, I think, has given $10,000 toward this reunion. And he arrived up at the Madison Inn last night. And he and I were good friends. He was on the freshman debating team, too. And he and I were also on the freshman basketball team, so I got to know Joe very well. And he said, "You were one of my true friends here in Madison." And I felt very happy about Joe's attitude, because I had absolutely no racial prejudice, you know, none. So. And in fact, when we had our interfraternity basketball team my sophomore year, I recruited Joe Fischelson and took his name up to Goodnight's office to have him enrolled as a pledge. Goodnight kind of looked at me, "Fischelson, pledging Theta Chi?" And I said, "Yeah." So he was legally pledged and played basketball for us. But the Jewish fraternities were strong, active, but it was quite unusual for a Jew to belong to it.
Was it sort of a separate but equal type of
atmosphere? Oh, yes.
Did you witness any anti-Semitism on campus actively or?
No, I can't.
What about, just briefly, the women's role on the Cardinal in the 30s, but essentially, what essential role did they play?
Well, of course, the society editor was always a woman, and she covered the social activities, parties, and so on. We always had women reporters, and they played an important role. Surprising that today, when you think back in those days, you know, women were not supposed to be accepted. But I think journalism and newspaper work is a field where they are accepted.
One other question about the Cardinal. What about, you're finishing up your senior year now, thinking about a newspaper career. What
did I do?
What happened? Did your experience at the Cardinal get you contacts in the outside world, or what happened?
Well, I went up to Julia Wilkinson, who was Glenn Frank's secretary, mm-hmm. and I had known Julia, and of course met the president frequently. I asked if she would arrange for some letters of introduction. I said I wanted to go east, and she asked me specifically what cities. I said not New York City, but Washington and Boston, I mentioned. I had an idea of Washington correspondent, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. I went to Boston first. And I had a letter from Glenn Frank to Edward A. Filene, who was mm-hmm. head of Filene's department store. Mm-hmm. Well, 34 was still depression. And he was very gracious, but there were no jobs in department store merchandising. And I also had a letter to an editor on the Boston Globe. Of course, Glenn, because he was mm-hmm. editor of Century Magazine, he had a lot of contacts in journalism. And then I went to Washington, and I had five different interviews there, and one of the Washington correspondents I met at that time was George Durno, another was Bob Allen, Kirsten Allen, and they were all very encouraging. In fact, Durno took me over to the Washington Press Club and gave me a temporary membership card and said, "You can use the typewriters here anytime you want and eat here, do anything you want." But no jobs. The only opening was fifth in line for a job as a copy boy on the Washington Daily News. So I wrote a letter to Cy Peterman, who graduated from Shawano High School and was then a sports writer on the Philadelphia Bulletin. And I asked Cy if there were any openings. He was a 24 graduate of the university. And he was, I mentioned, president of the Wisconsin Alumni Association in Philadelphia. And he called me and said, "I've just heard of an opening in advertising through another fellow on the Bulletin. And this man wants a writer." So I came right over to Philadelphia and Cy told me where to live and or where the interview was to be and so on. And they were kidding me about this last night because I told the fellows afterward that I walked into this advertising agency and the man, the president of the agency, said, have you had any experience in advertising? And I said, none. Never took a course in it. He said, you're hired. He said, I have too many people come in and tell me how to run the agency after a month. And he said, I want to train you. Literally, it wasn't that fast because he wanted to see the Daily Cardinals. And I had them sent from Shawnee. And he spent a whole weekend reading the Daily Cardinals and the editorials and so on. And he said, you've convinced me that you can write. And later, of course, I was in the advertising agency business all of my business career. But later, in looking for writers, I always favored people who came up through newspaper work because they're honest, eager, and great respecters of deadlines.
Yes. That's very interesting. So the the experience, the area that you didn't have any experience in when you were an undergraduate turned out to be the one that you ended up spending your
career. When I knew I was coming over to Philadelphia for this interview, I drew a book out of the library on Introduction to Advertising or something, and I got through about a chapter, but that wouldn't have done me any good.
You mentioned a name who was starting to pop up more and more in interviews and just all aspects of this project, Julia Wilkinson. He was Glenn Frank's personal secretary. As a matter of fact, secretary, I think, for five different presidents, starting with Van Hives. She died in office, as a matter of fact, in the lunchroom right next to the president's room, when Clarence Dykstra was president.
Yeah.
Tell me what you can about her personality and about her responsibilities.
Warm and affectionate, and I'm sure she never had an enemy. She was extremely affable. I don't know, you'd class her as a true friend. That's why, of course, I went to Julia when I wanted to get these letters.
So she was receptive to students as well as to
Oh, yes.
What about Glenn Frank? What can you tell me about him? He was, of course, beginning to become a controversial figure when you were...
He was, in my opinion, kind of a stuck shirt. I think he was hired really because of his national reputation and a feeling that he might be able to bring funds into the university. I think that was the reason for his selection. But professors told me, Glenn Frank doesn't know who his friends on the faculty are. And this is a pretty serious indictment, I think.
Yes. So in terms of your own undergraduate, sort of summing it up, the Cardinal was really a key, maybe the key, your involvement in the Cardinal here. That's fine. I want to move on to just a few other areas, and then we'll wrap it up. I know that you have a lot of friends who want to talk to you today.
I won't talk on about that now. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I say some of our fellows, three or four of them, are planning to come in here at 10:30. They wanted to hear an interview you had with this writer in Hollywood.
Maurice.
Yeah. So I'd like to hear that,
sure.
Too.
How much leisure time did you have?
Really not a lot of leisure time. I mean, bridge games after dinner at the fraternity house, inter-fraternity sports, those were leisure activities that I had, but mainly it was the academics and the Cardinal that occupied most of my time.
What about the Union? Did you go there very often?
Well, the Cardinal office was in the top floor of the Union, but socializing, no.
Did you do a lot of your socializing in your frat house?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You were here during Prohibition.
Yeah. Favorite drink was spiked beer.
Is that the etherized? Where did you get that?
It was delivered to the house by a bootlegger. And then, of course, the speakeasies around town, Jenny Magnosco's, and I don't know, a whole lot of them.
Did you go to speakeasies?
Oh, sure. And generally, the procedure was to go around to the back door of the house and knock on. You're admitted, and speakeasy was usually in the basement of the house.
Were they right around the campus area or something?
Yeah.
And catering to students?
Oh, yes, all students.
Were there many busts in those types of?
No, I can't remember any.
So the attitude, how would you describe the attitude toward alcohol during Prohibition?
Get away with what you can, yeah.
Was the same true from what you know up in Shawnee?
I would say so, probably. Mm-hmm. Of course, I remember one project, some department of the university, when near beer was legalized, asked for volunteers for a test, and you were given either beer or, the near beer or the real beer, and then after you'd had a bottle of it, you went through a series of tests, like going along a line, curved line, that kind of thing, and nobody knew what you were getting. So I never heard the results of this, but that was one thing that happened. Of course, while we were here, liquor came back, 34, I think it was, at DR, brought liquor back.
That's right,
it was
34. Yeah, 34. How did liquorized beer taste? I just have to ask you that.
Didn't have a pleasant taste. I mean, diluting beer, to me, is ridiculous, but it was one way to get a buzz on it.
Were there any books, magazines, records, radio shows?
Okay. You could walk down Langdon Street at 7 o'clock at night and hear Amos and Andy and practically every tribute. Huh?
When couples went on dates, where did you go for dates?
Well, the movies, the Orpheum was always popular there, and most of it's still there. A lot of dances, and you were invited to go to sorority dances and fraternity houses.
So for sorority houses would invite entire fraternity houses to dances?
Yeah.
Maybe one or two?
One, usually.
One?
Mm-hmm.
And were there places you went socially for drinks or for coffee or for,
Well,
a few names mentioned.
Last night we were looking for the Chocolate Shop, which used to be over on State Street. It's gone. There's something called the Chocolate Shop off a couple of blocks, but it's not
Chain
like the old Chocolate
place,
Shop. That was always a popular place with students, and we were wondering what happened to it. I mean, did taste change? I mean, this was a real sweet shop, and everybody liked to go there after a date.
We talked about alcohol, what about tobacco? What was the student attitudes about tobacco?
I don't recall any attitudes.
Wasn't sort of stuff a non-issue?
Right.
Okay. What about sports? What role did sports play in your experience here?
Well, everyone went to the football game, and we didn't have great football games in that era, but we always went out to the games and to the pep rally over here on the lower campus.
The pep rally would be the day before or the night before?
The night before, big bonfire.
Okay, let's talk about the pep rally. They'd be held here on the lower campus. There'd be a bonfire, cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Would people talk?
Yes. The players were all there, and yes, it was a real and arousing kind of event.
And what about other spectator sports? Basketball, boxing, any of those?
Well, basketball. What do they call the, where they play basketball now? I can't remember the name for it. But I mean, that was fairly new and excellent facility. But they didn't get the crowds really. They never filled it.
So it was really football that was the numero uno.
Football was the sport,
spectator sport. What about intramural types of sports? Were those big on campus?
Oh, yes, yes. The dormitories had their own intramurals, and fraternities and sororities did too.
Did they ever play each other?
Oh, yeah.
The frats versus the dorms?
Yeah.
How was your education financed?
My sister, who was working and supported my University of Wisconsin career.
Did you ever have a part-time job here?
I
talked about the Cardinals before.
Yeah, no. As a freshman, I went to the student employment office and asked for whether a meal job was available, and they sent me over to the University Women's Club on State Street, and I had one day there because I was watching the other fellows removing the cups and saucers from the tables, and they would stack them, saucer, cup, and carry three or four in each hand. So I thought that's the way to do it, instead of carrying one in each hand. So I was on my way to the kitchen with a bunch of these, tripped and fell and smashed all our cups and saucers. So the manager of the University Women's Club said, have you had your lunch? And I said, yes, I have. Well, he said, you're fired.
So
no, I never had any jobs.
Did you get paid for the Cardinal at all?
The payoff came at the completion of your year, and the business manager and the executive editor received the largest checks, and the Mel Wunsch is managing it, they got a check. But these were not large. I think mine was probably $800.
And it was based on?
4 years of work.
But it was how much you got was based on
how well the
paper did.
That's
and
right.
So the paper goes in into the red, you wouldn't have gotten.
That's right. We had an 8-page paper every day. That was a requirement.
Yeah.
And the Cardinal Publishing Company, which was independent, when we had enough advertising for 12 pages or 16 pages, they automatically pushed us into that, so we always had to have a backlog of filler material that could be used.
Last moment.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, Melvin was saying that they, the guy came in from Manchester's at the last minute, and he had to push it right up.
Yeah. Mel was editor at least one summer. I know.
Right. He did the commencement and the orientation. We talked about that. Did you ever have any student loans or scholarships?
No.
Discuss the role religion played in your campus experience.
Well, I belong to St. Paul's over here. In fact, I'm still on their mailing list. Mm-hmm. I get the mailings once a month. It was, I never participated in their social activities, but it was a regular church attending.
Did you, how did your campus religious practices compare with your pre-campus religious practices in terms of going to church and things like that?
Well, I always went to church, so there was no difference.
Okay. Okay. Let's talk for just a moment about the Dean of Men and the Dean of Women. I'll finish this up in just 5 minutes here. We've got another person coming in. Tell me what you can about Dean Goodnight.
Well, Dean Goodnight had quite a career here. And matter of fact, one of the women in our party last night said that he retired to Orlando, Florida, and that's where he died. In fact, she picked up two books on the history of the university there that I don't know whether Goodnight had authored, but he had signed them. But he had one famous, this was before I was on the campus, but he had one famous incident where he knew that a fellow and a girl had were in this room, and he got a rocking chair and rocked in front of the room till they came out. He was strict, but he was approachable too. And Louise Troxell was dean of women, and she was very well liked by the women on campus.
Did you ever have any experience with her?
No.
When you got summoned to the dean's office, now maybe not you personally, but when one got summoned to the dean's office, Dean Goodnight's office, would it usually be for a disciplinary problem?
Yes.
So, you would, is it fair to characterize him as being, at least perceived by students as being primarily responsible for the disciplinary behavior?
Yes, that's correct. And he was known as strict.
Yeah, the rocking chair incident, as you said, yeah. Seems to sort of characterize his reputation on campus, that he would go to any extremes to ensure the... What about Badger and Octopus? Were you involved with either of those?
No, I wasn't, but I knew the editors of both, of course. And we would confer occasionally.
Well, what was the... Did you spend much time in the library when you were a student?
Yes.
Well, tell me what the facilities, where it was and what the facilities were like.
Well, they were right across the street from the Union. It's now the State Historical Society. And I thought it was an excellent library and could get lots of reference books in.
Were the facilities adequate?
They were, as far as I was concerned.
State Street. Let's just talk for one moment about State Street. As far as you know, and as managing editor of the Cardinal, or as executive editor of the Cardinal, you might be able to answer this question better than most. You've already touched on it. Characterize the relationship that existed between the students and the merchants of State Street.
Oh, I think that the merchants knew what side of the bread and butter, and they welcomed all the student business they could get. The men purchased a lot of their clothing, right, on State Street, and there were some fine clothing stores.
Were there any particular notorious or famous or infamous characters on State Street that you, merchants?
No,
students?
I don't recall any.
Okay. Characterize the relationship between the police and students.
Boy, I can't remember any incidents at all.
Well, do we have university police at that time, or was it local police who?
Oh, I'm sure there were campus police. Yeah.
Student managers. Okay, we got into those pretty much. So your career goals when you left UW were for a career in journalism.
Writing. Mm-hmm.
Did you accomplish your career goals?
Yeah.
What are your current thoughts about the quality and scope of education you received at UW?
I think it was one of the most important 4 years of my life. I thought that the journalism school, I would rank among the top three in the country, and I still feel that way. Although my grandson, he wants to major in journalism, and he went to Georgetown this fall, last fall. I guess in the East generally they want to go to Eastern schools, but Wisconsin has a good reputation. I never felt ashamed of saying I went to Madison.
Okay, this is Barry Tyker from UW History Project. I didn't date this. This is May 10th, 1983. We've completed the interview.